Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
As instability grows in Cuba and Haiti, Washington has a message for would-be migrants hoping to cross the water.
This risk is not worth taking.
Also on the program today, for this woman, growing up in Sudan as part of the Christian minority was not easy.
People looking at you and telling you, oh, you're someone who's going to hell because you're not Muslim, you're not covering up your hair.
Now Sudan has a new government and it's trying to improve religious freedom. Also, a Guatemalan prosecutor fighting corruption flees his country under the cover of darkness.
He has very powerful enemies in the country.
And one competitive swimmer's story.
So I've started swimming when I was around 6 years old. I've always dreamt about attending the Olympics, representing Myanmar.
Why he decided not to go to Tokyo. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. For two nations in the Caribbean this month, things have been chaotic, to say the least. First, the president of Haiti was assassinated. Then in Cuba, historic street protests erupted. Both these events are still fresh. So far, we have not seen any mass exodus of Haitians or Cubans to the U.S. There is precedent for large-scale migration from both places, and in the past, U.S. immigration policies have treated Haitians and Cubans very differently from each other. Here's The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell.
It was 1991, and thousands of Haitians began fleeing a violent military coup against an elected president. People started jumping onto rickety boats for the U.S. The U.S. Coast Guard pulled Haitian families onto ships and then detained them at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Right, Guantanamo before 9/11. Many Haitians were considered economic migrants, not political refugees. That was controversial because political repression in Haiti had turned deadly. People were being assassinated for their politics. Former U.S. Representative Charles Rangel of New York spoke out about this in front of Congress.
Are we going to ask them whether they were shot at by an economic bullet? Was it a political bullet?
Tough legal battles did eventually stop many Haitians being held in Guantanamo from deportation. At the same time, though, Cubans also migrated to the U.S. for years, often in boats. In 1980, 125,000 Cubans fled Fidel Castro's dictatorship, but U.S. policy treated Cubans very differently.
Cubans, embraced by the U.S. government as political refugees, but then they were also granted adjustment of their status. They got green cards within a year.
Lilian Guerra is an historian at the University of Florida.
That kind of privilege is something that is also a direct result of U.S. political interests.
The Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966 is the Cold War era law that offered Cubans those special privileges, but the welcome hasn't always lasted. As more Cubans arrived, support fell and stigmas grew, especially against darker-skinned, lower-income Cubans.
So they are vulgarized. They are belittled. They are parodied in social media put out by Miami's Spanish-speaking Cuban exile and younger Cuban community.
Anti-immigration rhetoric in the U.S. also rose in the 1990s. So when another big round of Cuban migrant flotillas left again, U.S. policy shifted. In 1995, the Clinton administration implemented the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy. Cuban migrants intercepted at sea would be sent back. If you touched U.S. soil, you could stay. Critics called the policy crude, but it still set Cubans apart until 2017, when President Barack Obama suspended it. Now, generally, Cubans are treated like other migrants. Eduardo Gamarra is a political science professor at Florida International University.
They'll fly to Mexico directly. They'll fly to Venezuela. They'll fly to Ecuador. They'll fly to wherever they can obtain a visa.
Then, for many Cubans, it's on up to the U.S.
And for the first time, we have had the Cuban phenomenon on the border.
Pedro Luis Tamayo said he had to leave Cuba. He was an independent journalist, critical of the government.
Difícil es vivir lo que se vive allá adentro.
It was either leave the island or be jailed there, he says. First, he went to Brazil to work, and then to the U.S. border, where he got stuck.
Yo tuve 2 años en la frontera. Eso me ayudó a abrir los ojos.
He spent 2 years at a migrant shelter in Mexico waiting to enter the U.S. with permission. The experience opened his eyes, he says. He was with Central and South Americans hearing why others had left their homes. Tamayo was also allowed into the U.S. this year. He's in Miami now. Thousands of Haitians have also headed to the U.S. border, but have found it largely shut to U.S. asylum seekers for several years. That disappoints Gerline Joseph with the Haitian Bridge Alliance, a coalition of Haitian nonprofits.
And we are asking and urging and demanding that the U.S. government provide safety for those people, whether they are on boat or by foot.
That is not likely. This month, after Cubans protested for better living conditions and after armed men assassinated Haiti's president, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas issued a warning to migrants.
This risk is not worth taking. Allow me to be clear. If you take to the sea, you will not come to the United States.
Mayorkas, a Cuban immigrant himself, has reiterated the Biden administration's strict policies, like a health order that allows U.S. officials to seal off the border, citing pandemic risks. So far, there hasn't been a big rise in Cuban or Haitian migrants, but considering the recent turmoil, nobody is counting that out. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz was in Paris today to speak with the French Defense Minister on their agenda, Pegasus. That's the Israeli-made surveillance software sold to governments so they can spy on people's phones. Last week, the names of many people surveilled by the app came out, among them French President Emmanuel Macron. Now in the spotlight, the Israeli company that makes Pegasus, the NSO Group. Our next guest believes the Israeli government needs to do more to control the export of these surveillance tools. Itai Mack is a human rights attorney in Jerusalem, and he's been petitioning the Israeli government to do that. So how much oversight does the Israeli government have of NSO, the Israeli company that built the software?
The government has full oversight specifically on NSO because of the sensitivity of the Pegasus system. The problem is that the Israeli government doesn't do oversight on the target list. And of course, it's not possible to rely on countries like Saudi or Rwanda or Azerbaijan not to target journalists or politicians or opposition members.
But isn't the Israeli government supposed to screen export licenses?
The Israeli government policy for decades is that other countries shouldn't interfere in the Israeli internal issues, which means the Palestinians and the occupation, and the Israeli side don't interfere in other countries.
So you're basically saying that the Israeli government didn't want to interfere with internal policies in other countries, so they just approved this export license for Pegasus?
Exactly. And there's no difference in the Israeli government policy about surveillance systems to the Israeli government policy about selling automatic rifle and machine guns. It's the same story.
So you worked with Amnesty International on Project Pegasus that was looking into people targeted by the software. Why would French President Emmanuel Macron be targeted?
So first, it's important to clarify that President Macron's number was on a list of potential target, but it's still unclear if his mobile phone was indeed being targeted by the Pegasus system. I think it raised the problem that the French government, I think, is very worried if foreign countries is targeting French citizens, if it's Morocco or other country. But I believe that the French government is itself using a surveillance system. So there's a kind of a conflict of interest.
How exposed to charges of human rights abuses is NSO, the maker of Pegasus software, and by extension, Israel?
Well, if it could be verified that there were human rights violations committed with the Pegasus system, and we are not only talking about privacy, the system could be used to bring people into a prison. It could be used to get information that could be used in the torture room and to criminalize the civilian society all around the world. My arguments in the court here in Israel was always that Israel is not allowed in any way to assist in human rights violation, and it doesn't matter if it's being done through selling weapons or bullets or if it's selling a surveillance system.
Itai, what exactly are you asking of the Israeli government?
Specifically about the company NSO, I think that the government should freeze all its export license and also start giving the license not according to government, but also according to the target list. And this is the only way to verify that there are no journalists, human rights activists or politicians in the target list of Pegasus. And the second thing I'm asking the government to change all its armed defense export license policy to accept the Hebrew translation of the American law, which include the consideration of human rights.
Attorney Itai Mack speaking with us about the Israeli government's apparent support of a surveillance software, Pegasus, made by a private Israeli company, NSO. Itai, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Here's a novel idea. Make a mess, you pay for it. That's a message the state of Maine is sending to large companies. This month, the state passed a law that makes companies pay for the packaging waste they create. Nearly a dozen states are on track to follow suit. It's a new idea here in the U.S., but not in Europe. Scott Cassell works on this. He's the CEO and founder of the Product Stewardship Institute in Boston. So, Scott, let's start just to our north in Maine. What exactly does this new law require companies to do? What do you hope the outcome is going to be?
In essence, it requires producers to take greater responsibility for products and the packaging that they put onto the marketplace. So from a very basic level, there is a shift in cost from the municipalities and the taxpayers to the producers who put these products onto the marketplace.
So, for example, a company ships out a tiny widget in a giant box and that company's product is sold in Maine. What consequences would that company face?
They will be charged for the material. And then there will be extra charges for materials that have extra cost for the recycling system. So, for example, if it is a plastic that has very few markets, they're going to be paying more to put that onto the marketplace. If they put less packaging onto the market, if they have refillable containers, if they have reusable containers or highly recyclable containers, they're actually going to pay a lot less for those materials.
Nearly every country in the European Union has a similar law to the one just passed in Maine. What has been the impact on the amount of recycling and waste there?
Well, there's been a great evolution over the years. In 1994, they started with a European-wide directive. Over time, there's been a number of different iterations of that directive that have increased the collection and recycling targets over time, incentives to change the design of packaging, and it has even gone into reducing the environmental and social impacts on non-EU countries where some of this packaging material is processed. Here in the United States, we're at an average rate of 32% across the country for packaging recycling. Nearly all the participating EU countries that have these type of programs reach at least 60%, with many reaching 70 to 80%. You know, one individual I have to call out is Joachim Coden, who's the managing director of an organization called EXPRA. They manage or oversee all of the European nonprofit organizations that implement these programs.
We've seen a number of countries either limit or stop altogether receiving any recycled trash from the U.S. because a lot of it is not recyclable. China did that not long ago. Is that trend also driving laws like the one Maine passed?
Absolutely. The restriction of our recyclables being accepted in China has definitely catapulted this to the top of the political agenda because the costs have increased so significantly for municipalities. Many municipalities around the country have had to cut back on what they're collecting, or some have even stopped their programs altogether.
Scott, I'm curious. Joachim, your contact mentor in Germany who has helped you in your work in the U.S., what was his reaction when he learned you had succeeded with this law in Maine?
He sent me an email and he said, "Scott, is this really true?" Exclamation point. I think there were three of them because he and I have been going back and forth on this for a very long time. And Europe has started this program in 1990 with the German program. And here we're just getting to it in 2021.
Scott Cassell is the CEO and founder of the Product Stewardship Institute here in Boston. Thanks very much, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Myanmar has never won an Olympic medal of any kind. One athlete who hoped to change that is 27-year-old Win Tet U. He's a swimmer who qualified for Tokyo, but he's not there. Win Tet U refuses to compete under a flag that, in his words, is steeped in my people's blood. 6 months ago, the military in Myanmar staged a coup, and since then, security forces have killed nearly 1,000 civilians and locked up thousands more. Myanmar's military also took control of its National Olympic Committee, so athletes need the blessing of the junta to compete in the Games. Win Tet U spoke about all this with the world's Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen.
Win Tet U, how long have you dreamed of going to the Olympics?
So I've started swimming when I was around 6 years old. I've always dreamt about attending the Olympics, representing Myanmar as a swimmer. It's pretty much been a dream of mine for the last 2 decades. And I've been working towards it full-time since 2016, trying to get to Tokyo.
So the coup happened this year, ending a roughly 10-year run of more freedoms, more free elections. I know you are based in Australia, but how did that affect you?
It hit me and my family very, very hard. For the last few years, we've been very optimistic. We've been hopeful. I guess we were blinded by hope to believe that we would be a democracy. We came so far. And the younger generations especially only knew freedoms, even though compared to most democracies, it was very limited. Yeah, so it hit myself pretty hard, you know, just knowing that Myanmar just went back years. The country is once again firmly back in control of the military.
If the military controls everything, even the Olympic Committee, you will never compete in the Olympics. Is that right?
Yeah, I would only attend the Olympic Games under an Olympic Committee that the people of Myanmar are proud of and can control. And until that's the case, I think all Myanmar athletes should not be participating in any major international sporting tournaments.
Myanmar, under the military, did send two athletes to Tokyo this year, a woman named Tet Tar Tuzar, who plays badminton, and a pistol shooter, Ye Tung Nong. And you have said history will judge them. What did you mean by that?
The people didn't send them to Tokyo. It was the military that did. They sent a shooter whose background is in the Navy to Tokyo to show that the military is firmly in charge. It's a very symbolic act. And for a famous, you know, badminton player like Tet Tar Tuzar to go to Olympics next to this military man, I think it's a stain on her reputation as a sports person representing Myanmar. I reject her claim that she's doing it for the people. As long as she stands next to, you know, a man whose colleagues are killing people in Myanmar every day.
North Korea has gone to the Olympics, and Syria, and the United States has committed war crimes too. Would you have the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, bar those countries too?
Yes, I don't have the answers to that because it's a very difficult question to answer. But I do think that the IOC and the global sports movement, including athletes, coaches, need to sort of envision a future for the Olympic movement that's more humane and trying to use sports really as a means for peace and development and human rights.
In making the decision not to go, is it possible that you have run out of time and you'll never be able to compete in the Olympics ever?
Yeah, definitely. I knew that, you know, this is it. I just lost my only chance at going to the Olympics, and I'm completely fine with that because I identified with the Olympic movement for 2 decades, but it's not everything in life. You know, the fight for freedom means a lot more to me than being an Olympian. And I'd rather be on the side of history, of the people fighting for their freedom, than, you know, on my own side, you know, trying to find personal glory.
Win Tet U, the top swimmer from Myanmar, speaking there with the world's Patrick Nguyen about his decision to not compete at the Olympic Games in Tokyo. North and South Korea are speaking again. According to Reuters today, the two nations are in talks to reopen a joint liaison office that North Korea demolished last year. They also reportedly hope to hold a summit between the leaders of the two nations, part of a wider effort to restore relations. Joining me now is Jenny Town. She's a senior fellow at the Stimson Center and director of their 38 North program. What's your reaction to these developments, Jenny, and how do you explain the timing?
Well, I do think any time we can reopen communications channels is a good thing. Being able to have lines of communication to be able to try and avoid any kind of miscommunications and mishaps, especially in flashpoints like the DMZ. I think, you know, it plays well into President Moon and Kim Jong-un's broader inter-Korean peace regime campaign.
For North Korea, is this just a friendly overture, or does this attempt to reopen communication with South Korea suggest some domestic desperation in the North that could be mollified with diplomacy?
I think that's yet to be seen. I think both of those possibilities are real, that there may be some willingness to cooperate, especially on humanitarian assistance going forward. From what I understand, the situation in North Korea is getting... There's a lot of hardship going on now because of the prolonged COVID border lockdowns. So, you know, it's hard to get import foodstuffs as well as import inputs like fertilizers and stuff to help the crops. And so this year's crop will matter more than it has in past years.
So with that in mind, we've seen South Korean President Moon Jae-in go down this path of trying to bring all the sides together. A similar narrative now, or is this different?
President Moon is likely to try again to bring all the parties together and to try and get both US DPRK and inter-Korean relations back on track. I don't know that that's necessarily the intention of the North Koreans in trying to resume some level of talks with the South Koreans. But I think, you know, President Moon does also need to be very careful this time around in managing expectations of what's coming next, because it is a political cycle right now with the South Korean presidential elections early next year. So building up high expectations that things are going to move very quickly in a positive direction can work against him if it doesn't work out. It can work against his party. So trying to build too high of expectations on inter-Korean relations could be politically damaging to his party if it doesn't work out.
Looking back to President Clinton in the 1990s, one White House administration after another have said that the U.S. has to deal with the North Koreans so they can get rid of their nuclear program. Do you have any greater confidence, Jenny, that this time under Biden, it's going to work?
Certainly not going to be easy, and it will require, as well as concessions on the U.S. side, what is the U.S. willing to do to change North Korea's strategic calculus? We oftentimes think too much about North Korea as an exception, like that it's odd that they wouldn't want to have better relations with the U.S., that they should be willing to give up their nuclear program to have better relations with the U.S. But I think you have to ask yourself, what causes any country that has nuclear weapons to voluntarily relinquish that program? And so I think until we really solve the broader security situation, any administration is going to have a very difficult time trying to incentivize the North Koreans to give up their nuclear program.
Jenny Town is a Korea specialist at the Stimson Center and the director of their 38 North program. Jenny, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
More ahead in the second half of the show. You're with the world. These Olympics are like none other, and I'm not just talking about the pandemic. Athletes can now take you behind the scenes thanks to TikTok.
What the athletes are doing in their off time, and it's from their perspective too, so not like sending a camera crew from a network to follow this person around or anything like that.
Must-see TV that's not on TV. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For many years, Sudan in East Africa was singled out for religious intolerance. Critics came after the regime of Omar al-Bashir for imposing strict Islamist rule and allowing the persecution of religious minorities. But after the 2019 uprising that ousted Bashir from power, the new transitional government in Sudan has been taking a different approach, working to improve its international image when it comes to religious freedom. The World's Halima Gikandi reports from Khartoum.
Sunday morning mass is about to begin at St. Matthew's Catholic Cathedral in Khartoum. The towering stone church was built more than 100 years ago. The Arabic religious service is over. Now, people have come to pray in English. As they enter the main building of the cathedral, they kneel and cross themselves in front of the altar. The youth choir begins to sing, and everybody stands as the service gets started. Elizabeth Achu, a 31-year-old economist, grew up going to church here. Today, she's wearing a long, modest pink dress with a matching scarf around her neck. For Achu, St. Matthew's feels like a place of refuge.
And by saying refuge, I don't only mean the refuge that is written in the Bible and how it's being explained, but I literally mean refuge, like as in the dictionary, because of the so many things that I experienced growing up in Sudan as a black woman and as a Christian young woman in Sudan by then, during the Bashir regime.
Achu grew up here in Khartoum, but her family comes from the predominantly Christian South. In 2010, people there declared independence, and South Sudan became its own country. And that's in part because of the persecution that Christians and other non-Muslims faced during the rule of Omar al-Bashir.
I can just remember some kind of things that are being said while you're in public transport, people looking at you and telling you, oh, you're kafir, you know, like, you're someone who's going to hell because you're not Muslim, you're not covering up your hair.
Achu says she's forgiven those who discriminated against her. She'd rather think about the positive changes that have come since Bashir was ousted in 2019. Christians are more acknowledged and respected nowadays, she says.
We have like neighbors who walk in and say, oh, happy Christmas or happy Easter, before they used to think this is haram, you know. So there is some change.
Some of those changes have come from the top. Christmas is now a national holiday in Sudan. Non-Muslims are allowed to drink alcohol, and an old apostasy law was repealed. Now it's illegal in Sudan to even accuse someone of being an infidel or non-believer. Here's Minister of Religion Nasser Eddine Moufara speaking during a television interview last year. Sudan is a multi-religious country, the minister said. There's Islam, Christianity, and even the Jewish faith. He called on religious minorities who left Sudan under the previous regime to return. But for Elizabeth Achu, that invitation comes a little too late for many of Sudan's Christians.
You can see the church is not really full, like not even half full. So a lot of Christians are not here anymore because most of them are South Sudanese and they're not in Sudan anymore. The number has decreased a lot. And with that, of course, the effect of Christianity also diminishes.
There are still Christians across the country, Coptics in Khartoum, and Christians of different denominations in the Nuba Mountains and the Blue Nile. But most estimate that some 90% of Sudan is Sunni Muslim. That means non-Muslims have less political power, says Simon Suleiman. He's a Christian lawyer with the Sudan Council of Churches. Suleiman says that public festivities and celebrations are not enough. The new government needs to address tangible issues in order for Christians to feel included in society. The revolution has brought an atmosphere of freedom, he says, but change on the ground has been slow. For example, Suleiman says he wants to see more Christian television and radio stations, more Christians appointed to positions of leadership in the government, and for Christian teachers to be allowed to teach classes about their religion in public schools. Another sensitive issue, he says, are church properties that were seized under the Bashir regime. Those need to be returned. In the Umdurman suburb of Khartoum, children play and laugh outside a gated home. Inside the modest compound is a dusty courtyard surrounded by benches and a small cluttered office. Merry Christmas is written in large letters on a wall. Reverend Mata Budraskomi is a pastor here.
In this area, which we are sitting in, it is a church, but we are renting a house. This is a house of a believer. We are renting. That means we have monthly to pay for that in order to worship in this area.
They've been renting this house since 1997. It's small compared to the prominent mosque down the street. But Reverend Komi explains they haven't gotten permission to build a church here yet, despite multiple efforts. He says the former regime rarely gave permission to build new churches, even though most neighborhoods in Sudan have their own mosques. Informal churches that were built without permission were often destroyed.
Especially the Lutheran Church of Sudan, we have three churches destroyed and burned. One of them is in Saura, in Buluk 29, in Saura, in Umdurman.
Christian leaders like Komi want the government to issue building permits for new churches so that everyone has a place to worship. That, they say, would signal a commitment to religious freedom in Sudan. Back at the St. Matthew's Cathedral, worshippers drink tea and chat after Mass. As the night approaches, Elizabeth Achu, the economist, gets ready to go home. She wraps her pink scarf around her head, like a hijab, so she can blend in, she tells me.
I encounter a lot of men, Sudanese men, old men, who still hold these kind of perceptions of women covering up themselves and looking at South Sudanese who are residing here as foreigners. Why are you here? So it makes me more comfortable covering up.
But Achu says she feels positive about the changing attitudes in Sudan. The younger generation, she says, accepts people as they are. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Khartoum, Sudan.
Tomorrow we'll hear more about the experience of women in Sudan. These stories are part of our ongoing series, Sacred Nation, reporting on religion and nationalism around the globe, funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Check out more at theworld.org/sacrednation. The west coast of the U.S. might be on track for yet another record wildfire year. On the other side of the northern hemisphere, things are also bad. In the eastern Siberian province of Yakutia, intense wildfires have been burning day after day since June. Several million acres impacted so far this year. Here's The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
A blanket of smoke engulfed the regional capital of Yakutsk this month. Residents were urged to stay home, and an airport and highway had to be temporarily shut down due to low visibility. Many of the blazes are in remote areas of Yakutia, formerly known as the Sakha Republic. Volunteers are helping to fight fires closer to cities and towns. One of the difficulties is dealing with the smoke, volunteer firefighter Konstantin Brodnikov told Russia's NTV news channel last week. When you come close to the fire, when the earth under you is hot, he said, it's like smoldering sand. Independent scientist Sergei Zimov says there hasn't been much wind, so smoke has just sat over cities and villages. It's even reached his research station more than 100 miles away from the biggest fires above the Arctic Circle.
Therefore, there was maybe 5 or 7 days when we did not see the sun.
On our Zoom call, he showed me the gray sky outside his window.
I can see it just from window of my study. It's not so pleasant to breathe.
Like the western U.S., this part of Siberia saw a stretch of hot, dry weather this summer, topping 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or nearly 40 degrees Celsius. Siberian wildfire expert Yelena Kukovskaya says that's creating high-risk fire conditions.
Those days when they had the temperature reach 40 degrees Celsius, they have like 7,100 fires burning one day.
That's 7,100 fires. Last year was even worse when fires burned above the Arctic Circle through the beginning of winter. But carbon emissions are especially high right now, says scientist Mark Parrington. He's been monitoring the fires in Yakutia via satellite with Europe's main atmospheric monitoring program.
The emissions we're seeing now, only two-thirds of the way through the season,
those totals are actually higher than the full season totals of every other year back to 2003, apart from 2020.
Parrington says emissions from this one region of Russia are similar to those from wildfires across North America. Weather patterns at the top of the globe typically mean that either North America or Russia will have a bad wildfire year.
Generally, it kind of works a bit as a coin flip, but this year we are seeing fires in both.
Jessica McCarty directs the Geospatial Analysis Center at Miami University in Ohio. She says fires are nothing new to Siberian forests, but like in North America, the fire season is getting longer.
We're seeing fires as early as late April, early May, even when there's still ice in the rivers and the lakes. And we're seeing fires that extend well into the end of fall and the beginning of winter. And so fires are still burning past when the first snow is expected.
Permafrost is also changing in Siberia. It's starting to thaw in some places. When it does, peat, partly decayed plant matter that covers the ground in wetlands, can thaw and dry out. And when it dries, peat is highly flammable.
Essentially, it's just like those peat logs that you go and buy at Kroger to throw on your bonfire. That is what is burning. And then, of course, as it burns, it can cause more permafrost to thaw. And essentially, it sets up an area that can then be burned again in the next year.
Just how much peatlands are drying and burning isn't yet clear. Thomas Smith, a peatland expert at the London School of Economics, says it does look like some peat is burning this season. Videos from Yakutia show already burned forests still emitting smoke.
It appears to be emanating from the ground. And that would suggest that the soil is on fire. It's very characteristic of a peat fire if you still see the smoke billowing out of the ground.
In the last two fire seasons, Smith says about half of the fires were located on peatland. But it would take more on-the-ground research to understand just how much the ground itself is burning. Forests can recover from wildfires, Smith says, but...
The problem with peat fires, though, is that peat soil has taken hundreds or thousands of years to accumulate. And so when you burn the peat soil, the carbon dioxide that's produced, the greenhouse gases that are produced, enter the atmosphere, and it will be millennia before that carbon is resequestered in peat soils, if those peat soils ever recover in the first place.
Figuring out the extent of the damage in Russia will be key to understanding how much these kinds of wildfires are likely to fuel climate change. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
It's never been easy to prosecute the people responsible for corruption in Guatemala, but the Biden administration's efforts to partner with the country and Vice President Kamala Harris's recent travels there were supposed to bolster the rule of law. Well, that's not what seems to be happening. In recent days, a top Guatemalan anti-corruption prosecutor, Juan Francisco Sandoval, has been sacked. This weekend, he and his family fled the country, slipping across a land border in the early morning hours into El Salvador. It's a sort of story former judge Claudia Escobar knows well. Threats on her life led her to flee Guatemala in 2015 after she spoke out about corruption in the judiciary. Claudia, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So prosecutor Juan Francisco Sandoval has been called the most visible face in the fight against corruption in Guatemala. Tell us a bit about him and why he was fired.
Well, Juan Francisco Sandoval was the head of the special prosecutor unit that worked together with the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala for many years. So Juan Francisco Sandoval has investigated very powerful people from different sectors for more than a decade.
So Sandoval and a caravan of human rights activists, diplomats, and journalists, they drove across the border to El Salvador in the early morning hours on Saturday. Why would he feel like he had to leave under cover of darkness?
Well, you know, after the attorney general fired him without justification, he felt that he was in danger, and the people close to him made the decision to protect him and get him out of the country. Because you probably know, this is a region that is controlled by organized crime. He has very powerful enemies in the country. And in the past, prosecutors and judges have been murdered.
In response to the sacking of Sandoval, the U.S. government has suspended cooperation with Guatemala's Attorney General's office. What difference do you think that's going to make?
So if right now the government of the United States, the government of Biden, stops the aid that it gives to the Ministerio Público, it can mean that the Ministerio Público is not going to have the resources to do the investigation of all the criminal activities that are happening in Guatemala. So it can have a very serious effect.
Claudia, how long had Juan Francisco Sandoval been in his post as the anti-corruption prosecutor when he was fired?
Juan Francisco has more than 15 years in the Ministerio Público, working in different units.
What do you think it says that after being in the anti-corruption fight for so long, he leaves now?
You know, if somebody like him that has the recognition as a corruption fighter gets fired by the Attorney General, the other people that is looking after him, you know, that wants to work in a system that is broken and wants to make a difference, is going to think it over, because he's putting his life at risk for the country and putting the people behind bars, people that are destroying our society.
I mean, it all comes less than 2 months after Vice President Kamala Harris visited Guatemala. And at the time, President Alejandro Yamate told Harris he was on board with anti-corruption efforts and an independent judiciary. So where does this leave the U.S. now that this high-profile anti-corruption prosecutor has been fired?
Well, I think that really the USA has to take this seriously and think, you know, who are the partners in the fight against corruption.
Claudia, you and your family fled Guatemala in 2015. That was after you exposed how high-ranking Guatemalan politicians, including the country's vice president, were taking bribes. What advice would you give Juan Francisco Sandoval at this presumably very difficult moment for him?
Yes, I think this is a very hard time for Juan Francisco. It's like being in a tsunami and waking up the next day and realizing that you're in a place that you don't know, that you didn't want to be there. But I think that he needs to talk. He needs to speak out and speak out with the truth and expose the things that happen in Guatemala in this moment.
Claudia Escobar is a former magistrate of the Court of Appeals of Guatemala. She was forced to flee the country in 2015. She's been speaking with us about the firing of anti-corruption prosecutor Juan Francisco Sandoval. Claudia, thank you very much. Good to speak with you again.
You're welcome.
It's rare for the U.S. and Iran to meet. The U.S. hasn't had diplomatic relations with Iran for more than four decades. Today, the U.S. and Iranian basketball team squared off on the Olympic hardwood. Read more about the so-called basketball diplomacy at theworld.org/Olympics. UNESCO has announced its newest editions of World Heritage Sites. One particular entry on the list caught our eye. It's an ancient solar observatory in the desert of northern Peru. The site is called Chanquillo. It dates back to the year 230 BCE. The physical structure functioned as a calendar using the rising and setting arcs of the sun to define the time of year to within 1 or 2 days. Ivan Getzi is an archaeologist and the director of the Chanquillo Project. He joins us now from Casma, the Peruvian town closest to the site. Ivan, congratulations on this recognition from UNESCO. How do you feel about the honor?
I'm really overwhelmed with emotion. We have been working towards this goal for a number of years, and I'm truly blessed to be able to announce this to Peru on the day of its national holiday.
Yeah, that's very cool. So take us there. What does the Chanquillo Solar Observatory look like today? If I visit it, what would I see?
It is an amazing set of 13 towers on a monumental scale that were built atop a relatively small hill. But when you stand at the buildings that we call the observing points and watch the towers, what you will see is that the position of this giant ruler matches precisely the range of movements of the sun across the horizon throughout the year. The southernmost tower, tower number 13, follows exactly the position of the sun during the December solstice sunrise. Across the line of towers, if you look at tower number 1, it is perfectly aligned with the sunrise on the June solstice. And so all the dates in between throughout the year mean that every single day the sun rises or sets in relationship to the towers, and thus providing the means to determine the date with the precision of 1 or 2 days.
So those 13 towers, are they still there and still functioning?
They're still functioning today, twice a day, because there is an observing point for sunrise and there is an observing point for sunset. And they have been working like this with minimal disruption for 2,300 years. So the time that has transpired between the construction of this positioning instrument and today means less than half of a degree of displacement. So today you can see almost exactly what the ancient Peruvians saw when they were using the solar observatory. Very few places in the world can really offer such an immersive experience.
That is really amazing. So this solar calendar, was the calendar the same as our modern calendar, 24-hour days and 365 and a quarter days a year?
There are some differences. We can see that the ancient builders of Chanquillo, these ancient astronomers, clearly used the sun to determine the year. It is likely that they used the moon to determine period similar to our month. Other subdivisions we are not so sure about. The time that it takes from the sun, typically, to move from one tower to the next, it's about 11 to 12 days. So that is very different from a month, from a solar month, and very different from a week. So clearly, we are seeing evidence of a native calendar that has a completely different origin and that predates the calendars that we use today that were developed in the Roman era.
What do we know about the ancient people who may have used the Chanquillo Solar Observatory?
We don't know enough, but we do know that they clearly worshiped the sun. But we need to do more research to learn about what language they spoke, what they ate, how they buried their dead, or how they dressed. So we still have to do much more archaeological research to give us a greater picture of the society of astronomers and warriors that built Chanquillo.
Ivan Getzi is an archaeologist and the director of the Chanquillo Project. He's been speaking with us from near the site in Casma, Peru. Ivan, great to meet you. Thank you very much for talking about this.
Great to meet you, Marco. Thank you. Thank you very much for helping me spread the word about Chanquillo.
The U.S. audience for the Olympics opening ceremony hit a 30-year low on Friday night. Just over 16.5 million people watched it on TV. That doesn't necessarily mean people are not interested in the Olympics. A lot of folks are watching the games somewhere else, like on TikTok. The world's Bianca Hillier has our story.
Right now, there's a whole new Olympics world happening on TikTok.
So surreal to be here.
In every little cubicle, there are disinfectant wipes, so we wipe down everything that we're going to touch.
Deep fried camembert. I'm so excited.
Athletes have all but taken over the app, posting videos about dining hall food, free swag, and yes, the beds.
Yes, the beds are really cardboard, but it's really hard cardboard.
Sure, the official Olympics and NBC accounts post highlights of the day's events. But that's not what this is about.
You get to see things that you wouldn't have otherwise.
29-year-old Natasha Suri grew up watching the Olympics on TV. This year, she's watching on TikTok.
It's a lot more like behind-the-scenes action, what the athletes are doing in their off time. And it's from their perspective, too, so not like sending a camera crew from a network to follow this person around or anything like that.
That's important to Suri, who says she feels like she's getting to know the athletes as people, not just competitors. One of her favorites to watch is Alona Marr, a U.S. rugby player, who has shared why it can be intimidating to flirt in the Olympic Village.
It is not that easy to go up to a pack of 6'7" Romanian volleyball players and shoot my shot. I mean, I'll work on it, but I don't know if that's in the cards for me.
TikTok didn't even exist at the last Summer Games. But less than a week into this year's events, millions of people are watching athletes and team accounts. Videos with the hashtag Olympic Spirit have almost 1.5 billion views, like this one, where 7-foot-tall Argentinian basketball player Francisco Cafaro shows the limits of the Olympic Village showers.
I just don't fit.
On TikTok, you can also find Australian diver Sam Fricker taking a bike tour of campus.
Now, it's super big, so to walk the whole thing in this heat would take so long, so it's much easier to just jump on the bike.
He shows viewers the Village Salon and entertainment center athletes get to use, spaces that don't show up on TV. You could also watch Team New Zealand measuring their biceps for some reason. Or you could marvel at how Nigeria's Erica Ogoimike juggles the games with med school. You could even brush up on how the equestrian team's horses travel to Tokyo. But like all good things, Olympic TikTok will soon come to an end. That's hitting some fans hard.
Is it just me, or is anyone else starting to feel sad that eventually we won't have Olympic TikTok anymore? How will we go back to normal?
The credit here really goes to the athletes. In between winning medals, they're making people smile and are giving fans front row seats to an Olympics unlike any other. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
How will we go back to normal? Boy, that's a question that's aging gracefully. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Enjoy the Olympics however you watch them, and have a great evening. Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PRX.